It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and we'll be speaking with a guest who believes you should start eating bugs.
Wisconsin has the highest rate of drunken driving in the country, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and has gotten its share of criticism for its lax policies over the years.
Well, two Republican legislators, State Representative Jim Ott and Senator Alberta Darling, have introduced a set of bills. They did that yesterday, aimed at toughening Wisconsin's drunken driving penalties. Senator Darling is joining us right now. Thanks for joining us, Senator.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So why do you think Wisconsin needs tougher drunk driving laws right now?
Well, you just said it. We're number one in the country in binge drinking. And what we have are a lot of repeat offenders getting second, third, and fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth offenses, and something's got to be done. And we're one of the few states in the country that have the fourth offense the first time that a felony will be issued. So in reality, we're saying that if you commit a OWI one, two, or three times, it's basically a misdemeanor and really just above a parking ticket, and we don't think that's the right message for a public policy for public safety.
Now, while you make this case for these tougher laws, one of the things you've been faced with is a lot of people saying, well, it's just going to be too expensive.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Well, what we need to do is get into some alternative treatment models, and that will be put on the table with our other bills. What we think is that if we have tougher laws and if we let people know it is a serious offense and that Wisconsin's going to react that way and there will be consequences, and if there can be treatment along with the tougher penalties, we think that we can make great progress on lessening the number of repeat offenders, and that's what we really want to do. We want to say, look, Wisconsin is a state where public safety is extremely important, where families are extremely important, and we need to balance the scales of justice, and the victims of drunken drivers really are getting a very bad shift from the state of Wisconsin, because many of our people whose loved ones have been killed or injured have told us that they feel like, you know, their lives and their families are not as important as the offenders. So we need to balance the scales of justice. And, you know, when we talked about drunken driving laws before, Jim Ott and I have been working on this for several years, the cost comes up, but the cost of doing nothing comes up as well. When we made the fourth offense a felony, finally, a couple of years ago, we found that it did have effect on a number of incidences. So we think if we move it up to the third, we think we can have even better results. And actually, there are 25 other states that treat the third OWI as a felony. And in our neighborhood, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, go as far as to say the second offense should be a felony.
So as you work on this, you say you've been trying to do this for a while now. Do you talk to legislators in other states and try to get ideas from them on how to move it forward?
We do. And most of them will say that the cost factor is a driving obstacle, but they said by developing the will to attack the problem, what they have found that the dollar amount decreases because the offenders, the repeat offenders are decreased. And so, yeah, at first it is a pretty big shock to the system, but if you team the tougher penalties with treatment alternatives, and we found that in our neck of the woods, Rogers Hospital has done major research in biomarker approaches, a research approach to sobriety that some of the counties are using it now, like Waukesha and Kenosha and others. They have found great success with the drug courts with alternatives of treatment and with tough statutes on the books.
Now, when you talk about, you know, sort of drunk driving laws in Wisconsin, a lot of people say that it's difficult because of just the culture and actually the business of beer and alcohol in the state. Is that an issue?
Oh, definitely. But what we're saying, we're not against drinking. What we are trying to do is raise consciousness and awareness of responsible drinking. And if you're impaired, then being behind the wheel of a car is not the place you should be. And I think that discussion has to be put to the people. Most people don't know that it takes to the fourth repeat offense before the state will charge a felony. Most citizens don't realize that. And so I think we have to have this conversation in our state and talk about what should our policy be, what should our attitude be, and how can we better protect our citizens who are innocently driving in most cases, but then run into a drunk driver who can, in some case, that can result in deaths, as it has for the Jenkins family in Oconomowoc. His daughter was going out for her birthday party with her daughter, and she was pregnant, and with her daughter's friends, and Paul Jenkins will say he lost half of his family because one drunken driver who was a major repeat offender ran into her and caused the three of them to die.
In working on this legislation, were you able to find any other states where it's like Wisconsin, where it has to be the fourth time before?
Yeah, there are, but 26 other states, which is, you know, more than half, have the felony at a much higher level, third or above. As I mentioned, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota treat the third offense as a felony, but they also treat the second as a felony.
Now, in the past, the Tavern League has been an issue with getting legislation passed?
Yeah, and I think that we don't want to get into a fight with the Tavern League, because I think basically we both have the same goals. We want responsible drinking. We're not trying to say we want to end drinking. We want to cut down on people going out and having fun, going to bars and restaurants. No, what we're saying is we think that that's part of our culture, but what's missing in our culture is we have many too many people who accept being impaired, and getting behind the wheel of your car is something that is maybe at the status of a parking ticket. And that's not what most people in Wisconsin would want as a safety policy. They would not want to have us say, okay, your first, second, and third offense are like getting a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. And I don't think that's the nature of our state to say that. So we're not trying to say, let's totally change our culture. What we're saying is, you know, Wisconsin likes to party hardy, and that's all well and good. But when we party hardy, we should make sure we're not impaired when we get behind the wheel of a car, because it can be a very powerful machine that can cause great bodily harm to many people. And you're impaired if you are at twice the legal limit. And what they have, what the research tells us is when people are detained for impaired driving, that the legal alcohol level is twice that of the legal level, and that's a really major practice that we have to make people aware that you're really impaired when you're driving at that level. And while you don't intend to hurt anyone, accidents will happen, and those accidents have to be accounted for, because we have to value the life of the victims, and many people are severely injured because of a drunken driving incident. You know, some people are even getting breathalyzers at Walgreens, which some of them are very accurate, because they are concerned about their blood alcohol level. And if you're in Europe and Germany, for instance, in most bars there are breathalyzers before you leave. It's a common practice to check your blood alcohol level. And we just want to have this discussion in Wisconsin about what is responsible drinking and driving, and what should the culture be in our state. And I don't think we're saying we have to change the total culture in Wisconsin, you know, to say the beer brats and having a good time have to be changed. No, we're saying we understand that that is an important part of our culture, but we also think we need to be responsible when we get behind the wheel of a car.
Well, thanks for speaking with us today, Senator Darling. We'll be covering this as it evolves.
Well, I really appreciate your interest, Mike, and I hope you can help us get the debate going, because we want to involve citizens all over the state who have opinions on this matter, because in the end, it's the opinions of our citizens around the state that should prevail here.
Thank you very much. Well, that was Republican State Senator Alberta Darling of River Hills talking about her proposed legislation to toughen drunk driving penalties in Wisconsin.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll take a look at an overlooked source of protein. It's Food Friday, and we're eating bugs. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Michael Arnold. This is Central Time.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And it's time for Food Friday. This week we're exploring a unique slice of the culinary world, to say the least. Entomophagy is the word for it, or to put that in plainer English, the consumption of insects as food.
Now, eating bugs may freak you out a little bit, but consider this. An estimated 80% of the world's population eat bugs. It's just squeamish Americans, Canadians, and Europeans who don't. Eat bugs.
David George Gordon is a chef and a naturalist. He's the author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook, 40 Ways to Cook Crickets, Grasshoppers, Ants, Water Bugs, Spiders, Centipedes, and Their Kin. David, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be on your show.
Well, David, you're going to have to convince us a little here. Let's start with your story. What got you into cooking bugs?
Oh, you know, I write for a living. I like to write about fringy science stuff. And we're talking about the 1990s, I started collecting articles, mostly from science journals, about places around the world where people cook with bugs. These are like anthropology studies. Keep in mind, this is before shows like Bizarre Foods or Fear Factor or any Anthony Bourdain. So most of that information was in libraries. And I tracked a lot of that down to the point where I went, I really should be thinking about making this into a book. But so it doesn't just reach a scholarly audience, I thought a cookbook would be quite wonderful. And the book came out in 1998.
And it's a very nice-looking cookbook, actually. And, I mean, one of the points you make in the book, I guess, is that you think people should be more willing to eat bugs, right?
Yeah, and actually that's my current campaign. The book was re-released by 10 Speed Press just a month ago, so it's in a much more elegant setting. But, you know, we're basically a nation of bug bashers. Most people think bugs are gross and disgusting and germy and vile, and that's totally not true. And also, if we didn't have bugs, our planet would shut down in a matter of days.
Well, that's true. And I mean, I think the approach you take with this cookbook, I mean, it's rather interesting to look at. There are these beautiful photographs of the food, you know, whether it's 3B salad or white chocolate and wax form cookies. Or fried green tomato hornworms, where, I mean, the bugs are very obvious. And I believe that you intentionally did that, right?
Yeah, I mentioned that in my book. And this also goes back to the original book in 98. But I wanted people to know that they were eating bugs and what they tasted like. So I didn't want to bury them in exotic garlicky sauces. And I also didn't want to grind them up and use them as an ingredient in bread or something like that. For the most part, what you're getting are the bugs staring back at you while you're eating.
Right.
You can tell what a grasshopper tastes like and how it's different from a cricket.
Now, so Mike sounds like he's kind of into this already. So, David, I'm going to ask you for my sake. I need to be convinced a little about bugs, just the squeamish factor. I admit it, I have it, and I'm not a super big bug fan, either on a plate or, you know, crawling across my picnic food. What are some nutritional reasons that we should be eating bugs and stop being grossed out by them?
Well, yeah. First of all, I have to say 80% of the world's cultures eat bugs. We happen to be in that 20% that doesn't, and we're a very vocal bunch about it. We actually start dissing people that do eat bugs, whether we know it or not. And that's something that you need to get over. I'm sorry to be direct.
Well, but no, the thing is,
get over it. They're bugs.
I guess the point I'm making, though, is your cookbook has stuff that shows the bugs, which seems like that would creep people out more. And then you mentioned the Bizarre Foods show.
Yeah.
Which I mean, I think they kind of eat the bugs to creep people out. So is that doing a disservice to getting people to eat bugs if you're both creeping them out and introducing them to bugs at the same time?
I have to back up a little bit. First of all, bugs are incredibly rich in protein, pound for pound. They're about the same as lean ground beef. And they have vitamins and minerals, calcium, iron, all sorts of good stuff, and amino acids. So those are good health reasons to be eating bugs. But I want to address your second question also and say that I think in the future when people are eating bugs, they'll actually be ground up and mixed with other ingredients and be like a garden burger, let's say.
So that'll be like the sneaky chef technique you use with kids where you grind up the spinach in the Rice Krispies or something.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually a company right now called Chapul out of Salt Lake City that's making an energy bar with crickets in it. But it also has date sugar and things like that, chocolate. And I actually asked the manufacturer, well, how many crickets are in here, really? And they said 10, which is a lot.
Whoa.
But you couldn't see them. They were all processed. So people could get over their objection of, oh, this is gross. It's looking back at me. I can't eat it.
Now, but in your book, you mentioned that we are already eating bugs.
Yeah, we are, because there's actually all these FDA-approved levels of allowable limits of bugs that can be in our foods. And I'm sorry, I'm not great with numbers, but any processed food like peanut butter or jams and jellies or even chocolate will have allowable number of bugs or bug parts in it. Someone actually calculated with those allowable limits from the FDA, in a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, there can be as many as 57 bug parts.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
So bug appetit.
That's a lot of bugs in a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Well, I want to ask you, I would be more inclined to eat something, and I think most people would, if it's tasty. So what is a good gateway bug, a good tasty bug when you just want to dip your toe in the pond?
You know, I'm very fond of crickets. They're easy to make. They're hard to screw up, and they're available year-round. You can go to a Petco or some large pet store that sells live food for pets. And you can buy crickets. You can even specify what size you want them. And in my book, I explain I like four-week-old cricket nymphs because they don't have their wings yet, so they're not as crunchy as the grown-ups. What I do is I freeze them, then I defrost them. And for people who just want a gateway experience, just put them on a cookie sheet and bake them at low heat for a while and season them and serve them.
So if you get them at the pet store, though, they're alive, right?
Yeah, that's right. They're alive when you get them. You have to put the bag in the freezer. Because they're cold-blooded animals, they drift off into a deep sleep and they never wake up.
Okay, so that's humane.
Just like people in Madison, Wisconsin in the winter.
This is true. What do they taste like, though? What is the flavor?
When they're roasted like that, they have a little bit of a nutty taste. But also sort of they have a little savory taste. So let's say nuts and mushrooms.
That sounds okay. I like both those things.
One time I was in a hurry and I just microwaved some for a program, frozen ones. And without anything done to them except microwaving, they tasted very faintly of shrimp.
And that was kind of something interesting that I think you talk a little bit about crawfish and how there are some similarities between some bugs and crawfish and how it tastes. Is that right, or am I?
Yeah, a lot of the bugs taste like seafood.
Yeah,
crab or shrimp. But you know what cracks me up is that people have no problem eating lobsters and shrimp and crayfish. You know, we're used to those. Somebody said to me, "Well, they come from the ocean. Like that's supposed to make a difference." And, you know, the pilgrims, when they landed at Plymouth Rock, they were appalled at the idea of eating lobsters. They used them to fertilize their farm fields instead.
Bugs don't really have meat on them, though, right? So where's all the nutrition coming
from?
Well,
they do have meat on them. You know, meat is basically muscle, whether it's a cow or a pig or a chicken. We like the muscle. And they have muscles in their legs. Grasshoppers, for example, have really long, strong muscles in their jumping legs. Tarantula spiders have great legs to eat. Delicious. Scorpion tails are really good. Any place where you find that muscle.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're also eating a lot of organ meat. If you pop a cricket into your mouth, you're mostly getting what's inside the cricket.
So it seems like, you know, where would you get your recipes? I mean, you have your book, I guess, but how did you come up with your recipes in the first place?
Oh, yeah. You know, first off, I went to a lot of there are a couple of large reports that are out. One published in the 50s called Insects as Human Food, which I find is a wonderful title. I'm waiting for the movie to come out.
I think it was a movie.
And it talked about all the different places around the world where people ate insects. So I sort of studied that and then tried to develop recipes based on what they were describing. For example, they say in Indonesia they catch dragonflies and cook them in coconut milk.
Hmm.
So I just invented my own recipe for that. And in Indonesia they call those sky prawns. It's a great title.
That's a great name.
I used that for my recipe in the book.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today. And we do have a recipe that we're posting on our Facebook page of a 3B stew of some sort. So that's going to be up there.
3B salad.
3B salad. All right, David, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on.
That was David George Gordon, author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll explore the world of fantasy football, which has gone from a niche subculture to a national pastime.
We'll also take a look at the problem of overfishing and what happens when fish run out.
And also we'll talk with a guest who has some ideas on how to keep our writing shorter and more to the point in the age of Twitter and instant messaging.
That's all coming up and more on Monday on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When police began mass arrests of protesters gathering without a permit in the state capitol last week, it marked a change in strategy for officers. In essence, they used handcuffs and $200 tickets to send a message that the capitol's permit rules would be enforced when it came to the daily solidarity sing-along.
It was a judgment call, the kind police make every day, but this one has created a near-daily spectacle at the capitol. Sean Johnson has more.
An arrest can be a dramatic event, an attention-getter. There's a reason police shows are popular on TV, and even they grapple with when to use their power. Consider this scene from HBO's The Wire.
Somewheres, back in the dawn of time, this district had itself a civic dilemma of epic proportion.
That's Major Howard Bunny Colvin, a fictional veteran of the Baltimore Police Department, telling his officers about the time the city council passed a law that forbade alcoholic consumption in public places. That meant in the streets and on the corner, which Colvin calls the poor man's lounge. He says officers were in a bind.
They arrested every dude out there for tipping back a high life. There'd be no other time for any other kind of police work. And if they looked the other way, they'd open themselves to all kinds of flaunting, all kind of disrespect.
It might sound like a stretch to compare what happened in the mean streets of The Wire to what's happening in the marble halls of the Wisconsin Capitol, but UW clinical professor Michael Scott doesn't think so.
It's not a stretch metaphor at all. It's a good one. This is, in the parlance of policing, what we call the exercise of discretion.
Scott is a former police officer, a fan of The Wire, and the director of the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing. He says the exercise of discretion is the glue that keeps society together.
There's no community that I know of, in the United States at least, that genuinely wants full, strict enforcement of every law on the books. The people simply would not tolerate it in any place, under any conditions that I can think of.
Scott says police are constantly making judgment calls about what to enforce. And in the Capitol, he says they're breaking from past practices. For more than a week now, Capitol Police have prioritized a section of administrative code requiring a permit for organized events of a certain size. They use an oversized megaphone to make daily declarations that the rule is being violated by the Solidarity Sing-Along.
Please move your group outside or disperse immediately. If you do not, each participant is subject to arrest.
The voice on that recorded message is Capitol Police Chief Dave Irwin. He declined requests to discuss the latest arrests. Other police defer to Irwin here. Dean County Sheriff Dave Mahoney, who in the past criticized the Walker administration's use of police to restrict access to the Capitol, says this situation is different.
If the Capitol has implemented a rule that you need to obtain a permit so that they can conduct daily business and ensure that everybody has the right to come forward and express their view, why not abide by the rule?
The practical effect of the arrests is that, at least for the short term, they've attracted more protesters to the Capitol. How did police on The Wire handle their problem? Major Colvin tells officers that a compromise was reached. People could drink on the streets if they kept their bottles in a paper bag.
And it gave us permission to go and do police work.
The Wire comparison gets thin here because in the more than 1 week since mass arrests began at the Capitol, there's been little talk of compromise. It's a real-life police drama, and there are no signs that it's about to be canceled. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks for that, Sean. And speaking of The Wire, we'll be talking with Grammy Award-winning musician Steve Earle, who acted in The Wire. He'll be playing in Door County tonight and Madison tomorrow, and we'll be talking with him in about 30 minutes.
But right now, we're in the middle of the summer blockbuster season, or are we? Several expensive, high-action movies have already failed. Here's a clip from one of those movies, Pacific Rim.
Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
And a clip from the blockbuster, or so-called blockbuster, Pacific Rim, that tanked. Here's another one, another failed blockbuster, this one from The Lone Ranger.
From the great beyond, a vision told me a great warrior would help me on my quest. One who has been to the other side and returned.
Hi-ho, Ranger, indeed. The Lone Ranger, Pacific Rim, White House Down, all these movies cost millions to make, but ended up flopping at the box office.
This has got a lot of people wondering, is the Hollywood blockbuster over? Here to talk about what's going on in the movie industry is Linda Obst, head of Linda Obst Productions. She's the author of Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So let's get a handle on what's going on in the movie industry. What's happening with all of these huge blockbusters flopping?
Well, let's not forget that July and June were as good as August is terrible. Avengers, Man of Steel. So there still are some very successful blockbusters. But the problem is there are too many blockbusters. There are too many movies aiming for franchise dumb, if we can call it that. And the ones that are aiming for franchise dumb and missing all seem to be coming out in August in very crowded dates. And they're not going to make it to their sequel, are they?
So is getting your hands on a franchise sort of the holy grail in the movie industry because it's sort of financial security?
Exactly. And that, I think, is at the root of the problem. Movies are no longer made to be movies, to be original so-called movies, one-offs, like Forrest Gump or Braveheart or Moonstruck or Driving Miss Daisy or some of your favorite movies that you may remember, Casablanca. Movies are made to be billion-dollar babies, to be franchises like Fast and Furious, an incredibly successful series based on an original premise. That's the goal of a movie, is to be turned into a business proposition and to be sequelized and then turned into a franchise where in its sixth iteration it has so much what we call pre-awareness. The international audience is so aware of it that it can be iterated and iterated over and over again until it can be known forever. And there's a reason for that. And that is that the international audience, which is now making the responsible for the bulk of our profits of the movie industry, is dependent on two things. Pre-awareness, they have to know the title of the movie. And there are only so many projects like Batman or Spider-Man or Superman that are known internationally just on their titles. Basically, a project gets to be known, a movie gets to be known internationally by making multiples of them, like Fast and Furious. So, or by having a book that becomes so widely known, like Harry Potter, that but there are so few of those things.
Now, is that because Hollywood right now is on tenterhooks, wondering if the industry is going to come crashing down thanks to everybody watching TV shows or streaming movies?
No, it's because the DVD market collapsed in 2006. And so the profits that sustained the industry used to come 50% from the DVD. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
That's a huge number. I would never have thought that many people bought DVDs.
Yes. It was one of the most astonishing things I learned in my research when I tried to figure out why it was so hard to get the kinds of movies made. I used to get made all the time. My rom-coms, my comedies. It was so hard to get an original movie made, and I couldn't figure out what had changed. And it turned out that what it was that 50% of the profit and loss statement of every movie had come from the DVD value of that property. And that's enormous. And apparently, both the library of the DVDs and the purchases of DVDs of those movies were the most profitable part of the entire business. But with privacy and technology, the movie business suffered the same fate as the music business did before it and the publishing industry did. which is implosion. But the movie business was lucky because it had another source of profits that the music industry didn't. Well, the music industry had touring, right, which is now responsible for all of its profits. And the movie business had the growing new emerging international markets, basically the new capitalists in Russia and China, and the new middle classes that were growing in the emerging markets like Brazil and India. Suddenly, India was building tons of multiplexes out of its theaters, and Brazil was having a great emerging market. But fundamentally, China and Russia were the biggest emerging markets with all their newly minted capitalists. And these markets couldn't get enough of our amazing special effects. The same technology that sort of imploded the DVD market was creating the ability to do effects that nobody in the world had ever seen before. And the first iteration of that was Titanic and Jim Cameron's amazing ability to, in Titanic, tell both a love story on a Romeo and Juliet on a boat, but also do it in 3D with these astonishing water effects that nobody had ever seen before. And then Avatar. And those movies literally opened markets in areas and opened theaters in areas that had never been there before. China started building theaters at the rate of 1,000 a day.
Wow.
And these markets were looking at things, and around the world, people were looking at things, in America as well, that were astonishing, that minds were being blown all over the country, all over the world.
So is that why Hollywood is trying to do these blockbusters now, trying to play to that same special effects appetite that opened those doors in the first place?
Exactly, and it works. The international audiences can't get enough of our special effects, can't get enough of our big action sequences, our amazing sound, our amazing ability to do bigger and bigger car pileups, blow up cities in more astonishing ways. But the problem is what the international market loves and can't get enough of isn't the exact same thing that the domestic audience wants, which is what you see in August. A pileup of movies that were basically created for the international market, movies like Pacific Rim, which was created for literally the area that the title indicates, right? Pacific Rim. Mm. But that are launched for these foreign capitals, like thermonuclear devices, right? Huge movies built for these foreign markets, because they're primarily movies that can't rely on wit or nuance, right? Because you can't have too much dialogue in a movie built for Asia, because it takes too much looping. You can't have a comedy because wit is local, right? What somebody thinks is funny in China is different than what somebody thinks is funny in France. In fact, it's not even funny in England across the channel, right? Comedy is local. So when people go to comedies, they go to their local movies for comedies. When they go for romances, often they go for their local romances. But what they want from America is big action movies with astonishing techniques that only we can create.
And Americans are going to these movies, and we've seen it all before, and maybe we're kind of sick of seeing things blowing up in big ways. Maybe we're hungry for the nuance again.
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening. So what the domestic audience is craving, which is something different, is very different than where the profits are coming from, which is in the international market. So the studios are hoping that the movies make up the difference of the money in the international markets and kind of ignoring the taste of the domestic market. The problem is that if a movie doesn't make enough money domestically, it's not going to get a sequel. And if it doesn't get a sequel, it won't be a franchise. And then they've spent $250 million on the first model and almost as much as that to market, and then it doesn't get its shot to become a franchise, and all that money is a write-off. And that's what Steven Spielberg was talking about when he said, this business model is a disaster, right? Obviously, if you have the Avengers as a property, if you own Marvel or you have DC comic books, you have what I call in the book first-tier properties, right? First-tier, what we call in the movie business IPs, intellectual properties, right? If you have Superman, if you have Batman, then you know that you have a property that's worth exploiting for $250 million, right? It's going to turn into a franchise.
All right, we're going to leave it there for now as we're talking to Linda Ose. We'll come back and take some calls talking about the changing landscape in Hollywood.
We'd like to hear what you have to say about this. Are you blockbustered out, tired of those explosions and crazy movies? Do you still go to the movies? Or do you wait to rent or watch stuff on Netflix? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll be taking your calls next. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And we're taking your calls now on the state of Hollywood. Do you still go to the movies? Why or why not? Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or comment at the Central Time Facebook page to let us know what you think.
And we're talking to Linda Opes now, head of Linda Opes Productions. She's the author of Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. And Linda, before we go to phones, just real quickly, aren't there exceptions to this rule? Are there nuanced movies that are being put out by Hollywood that are international hits that don't rely on explosions?
Well, there are certainly movies that confound the studios. There are movies like Bridesmaids, which almost didn't get made and was made that had four unknown women at the time that were TV stars that looked like it would never work abroad. And other studios would never have made it. And first of all, it was women. And second of all, they were television people, and nobody had ever heard of them internationally. And then the movie did hugely in America and then did really well abroad. And now Melissa McCarthy is an international star, and she opens with Sandy Bullock, The Heat, which in the middle of August, when everything is failing, is a success. So it shows that you still need gut in the business, and no formula is working automatically. And Bridesmaids was not a title with pre-awareness. It wasn't built for a franchise. It isn't sequelizable. So it defeats all the rules that are operating right now for building franchises, and yet it worked internationally. The audience loved it, and it was something completely different. Women, I think, are starved for movies.
But Hollywood loves its formulas, so we're waiting to see what comes next. Well, let's take a call. Stephen in Lake Geneva is with us. Hi, Stephen.
Great show. Thanks for taking my call. I went to see two of the biggest blockbusters over the summer, and I ended up taking both my nephews to to one of them, being Man of Steel, and the other one I saw was Pacific Rim. And something that I noticed with both of these films is that I fell asleep in both of them, first of all, and I figured out the reason why after I saw them, and that was because they're both trying so hard, and they're just so packed full of nonstop action sequences that just kind of had this non-effect, this white noise effect that just kind of made me totally non-interested. And I just feel like I just noticed that as a pattern. And I actually just saw E.T. not too recently, and that was obviously a huge blockbuster hit with kids. And I was surprised at how thoughtful and kind of cerebral it was, as well as appealing to kids. And I feel like that's gotten lost in today's landscape. And I'll take my comments off here.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Wow. So that is the exact opposite effect that the studios wanted. This guy, Stephen, is falling asleep at blockbusters. What's happening there?
And they're so loud.
Right.
You know, and there's so much sound design. You know, there's almost more sound design than there is story design. And in fact, it's not almost. There's so much more sound design than story design.
What about that phrase he used, white noise?
Well,
is that what these movies are?
Stephen's completely right. Excuse me?
Yeah, I was just going to say, is that what these movies are, white noise?
Well, I think he's completely right. It's so interesting because, you know, people get all these sound awards and the movies are supposed to be so brilliant and they're Dolby sound, and it all ends up sort of canceling itself out because there's so little character. I noticed in the Pacific Rim poster in the one sheet that there were no actors, you know? It was all robots and something, you know, they were all mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things that's so extraordinary about E.T. is how emotional it was. And we can still remember how we felt when we first saw and met the alien with the child. I think that if E.T. came out right now, it would be the exact same blockbuster that it was then, and both for the international audience and for the domestic audience. Look at how Life of Pi did last year. And Life of Pi was a movie that took a girlfriend of mine, the head of Fox 2000, many, many years to get green lit and get made, with tremendous resistance from her studio. And yet, the hunger for something different, the hunger for something emotional and spiritual that existed in that movie was so palpable when the movie came out. And it completely confounded the people that are making movies for this blockbuster audience, and yet it became an international and a domestic blockbuster. Yeah. It's almost as though the things that people assume the international audiences want aren't necessarily what they want. It's the lowest common denominator of what they want, but not what they crave.
Oh, it's an interesting take on that. Well, let's get another call in quick. We're running short of time here. Amy in Amherst, you're next. Hi.
Hi. I guess I just wanted to make a comment that if I'm going to take an evening or a weekend to see films, one of the things we've enjoyed is going to local film festivals, because you may see some good films, you may see some not so great films, but at least it's fresh and it's interesting and it's new. And I don't know, I found that I really would rather spend my time and money there.
All right. Thanks for that, Amy. And indie films, is that the way to go, Linda? And by the way, we've got about a minute for your answer.
Yes, I think it's the indie market has never been more exciting, partially because movies that used to be made by the studios are now indies. The marginal film that used to be what we called the film, the movie, is now an indie film. So absolutely. And also I think the audience wants fresh and wants to be able to discover something as opposed to being clobbered over the head with it.
All right. Well, Linda, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be keeping an eye on what Hollywood does next. It's interesting stuff right now.
Sounds like Wisconsinites are very smart.
I would agree with that. All right. Thanks a lot. That was Linda Opes, head of Linda Opes Productions, a TV and film company with a first look deal at Sony Pictures Television. She's the author of the book Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business.
Coming up next, we're talking about the recent travel alert just issued by the State Department. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And don't forget, you can keep track of what we're doing here on Central Time by liking us on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also keep discussions going like this one. Let us know what you think about these Hollywood blockbusters. Are they hitting the snooze button for you too? Are you falling asleep? And are you hungry for the more emotional films that Linda was talking about? Films like Life of Pi, maybe a throwback to a movie like E.T. Let us know on Facebook. You're listening to Central Time right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.